Good evening. My name is Eliza, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Midwest Regional Teleconference Series. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Please note, questions should be limited to one per person. Thank you. I will now turn the call over to our moderator for this evening, Ms. Judy Oberhoy. Ma'am, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, Eliza. Good evening, everyone. My name is Judy Oberhoy, and I'm from the Mid-America chapter of the National MS Society. On behalf of the Society, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program on Cognitive Changes in MS. This program is brought to you through a collaboration of the Greater Illinois, Gateway Area, Indiana, and Mid-America chapters. Together, we provide programs, services, and research to improve the lives of people affected by MS. Audio recordings of this call will be available through each chapter for anyone wishing to refresh their notes or to share with a friend. Dr. Bruce has also created a PowerPoint for his presentation, which will be available on the websites after the call. We would also like to mention that we are in the midst of Walk MS season and encourage you to get involved with a walk in your community. There's a wealth of opportunity made available by the Society through our local chapters for all levels of participation. We encourage you to reach out to your local chapter by calling 1-800-344-4867 or by visiting their website for a list of upcoming events and programs. We'd also like to take a moment to thank Bayer Healthcare and Biogen IDEC for providing partial funding to the teleconference educational program. A special thank you to our presenter who is donating his time for this presentation. Please note that during the first part of the program, during our speaker's presentation, you will be in listen mode. Feel free to jot your comments and questions down as you listen. Following the presentation, the operator will open the lines for questions. Please listen for their instructions. We're fortunate tonight to have as our speaker Dr. Jared Bruce, Assistant Professor in the Department of Psychology at University of Missouri, Kansas City. Dr. Bruce received his undergraduate degree in psychology from University of Maine and both his MS and PhD in psychology from Penn State University. He has done extensive research in the area of MS and cognition, including memory, depression, and processing. In 2008, he was awarded a pilot grant from the National MS Society to study the association between neuropsychiatric symptoms and treatment adherence in MS. Dr. Bruce also serves on the Clinical Advisory Board of the Mid-America Chapter. I would now like to welcome Dr. Jared Bruce.
Thank you very much, Judy, and I want to thank everybody here for taking the time out of this day to listen to this talk and learn a little bit more, hopefully, about cognition in MS. Here in Kansas City, the weather is wonderful, so the fact that you dialed in your region, if it's this wonderful as well, is a testament to wanting to learn more about MS, so thank you very much. The title of the talk today is Cognition in Multiple Sclerosis, and I know some of you have slides for this and some of you don't. I'll try my best to accommodate everyone, whether you have slides or not. When I talk about cognition in MS, that's really just a fancy word that psychologists use that means thinking skills. And so as I say cognition throughout the talk, what I mean is thinking skills, things like memory, attention, language, how quickly you can think, and things of that nature. First, let's talk a little bit about what MS is and how thinking might be interrupted in MS. So, as many of you I'm sure know, MS is an autoimmune disease. So the immune system normally functions to fight off invaders. And if it's functioning healthily, it will fight off things like viruses and the flu. But in MS, for some reason, it attacks the brain and attacks the spinal cord, causing significant problems in thinking, but in other areas as well, physical problems, emotional problems. We'll talk a little bit about each of these. MS is the most common neurological disorder among young adults. Most people who get MS will get it between the ages of 15 and 50. In this way, MS is really different from most other neurologic disorders. Most neurologic disorders impact people later in life. So, for example, people who have Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease, these are diseases that tend to strike people as they get older. But MS really strikes people oftentimes in the prime of their life. And this creates a whole host of different circumstances and problems. People with MS are frequently working. They have children. They are raising families. They might be taking care of their own patients or their own parents. And so the types of cognitive demands on people with MS can be really quite substantial. And when you have cognitive difficulties, having to navigate all these different things at once, juggling all these different tasks, can really be quite a challenge. On the microscopic level, what's going on in the brain is that this autoimmune process is attacking the fatty tissues that surround nerves in the brain. And that fatty tissue serves to both nourish those nerves so they can communicate with one another effectively, but also it speeds up transmission between nerves when they communicate with one another. When the immune system attacks that fatty tissue or myelin, it can impact cognition in a negative way. It can slow information processing speed. Things can seem much slower than they once were. It can affect memory and affect a lot of other thinking skills as well. But you can also see this by looking at MRIs and looking at the types of brain lesions people have when they're experiencing flare-ups, for instance. So, for example, people with relapsing remitting MS and sometimes people with secondary progressive MS will have flare-ups or exacerbations. And if you have slides and you're following along, we're on slide 5 here, you can see that there's one person who's having a flare-up on the left, and you can actually see the changes physically and structurally in the brain that are occurring as a result of that flare-up. The same person, picture of that person's brain right next to it, that flare-up is cleared up. And so we know that structural brain changes are associated with changes in the brain, but are also associated with changes in function. And that's what we'll talk a little bit more about later, how these brain changes influence cognitive or thinking skills, functioning. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about some of the other symptoms of MS, because I think they're relevant as well. Perhaps the most obvious symptom of MS are physical symptoms. In some ways, cognitive symptoms are invisible. You can meet a person on the street and not necessarily know that they have any problems with their memory. On the other hand, if you meet a person who has to use a cane to get along, it's really salient. You can see, oh, this person has difficulty walking. And it's perhaps for that reason that most of the research over time and over the last 100 years and most of the clinical attention has been on physical symptoms of MS. And they're really important symptoms, things like visual disturbances, maybe having double vision, difficulty tracking objects with your eyes, feeling numbness or tingling, coordination problems, muscle spasms, pain, paralysis. These are really, really important things. And they've gotten a lot of attention, perhaps because they're usually observable. Cognitive symptoms aren't observable. The only way that you can see cognitive symptoms is by doing complex tests or asking people how their thinking is. And in that way, it's harder for people to understand when you're having cognitive difficulties than it is if you're having these more obvious physical difficulties. Emotional symptoms are also common in MS. Again, related to the brain changes as a result of MS attacking the brain, but typical emotional problems in MS include things like feeling agitated, feeling worked up, feeling irritable. Sometimes people with MS will experience something called pathological laughing or crying. This is laughing and crying for no apparent reason. You might laugh even though something's not funny and can't stop laughing, or you might cry even though you don't even really feel that sad. But the most common emotional symptom of MS is depression. There's been a lot of research on depression over the last 20 years or so in MS. And it turns out that maybe more than 50% of MS patients will experience depression at some point in their life. And we know that some of that's related to the brain changes directly associated with the disease, but some of it's also related to the difficulties coping with what MS brings you in life. It's not easy to have MS. It's not easy to deal with the physical symptoms that you might have, the cognitive symptoms that you might have, how that can impact your personality or your relationships with others, your work. And so coping with the changes MS can bring is also associated with depression. Anxiety is also common. About 20 to 25% of people with MS at some point in their life will meet criteria for an anxiety disorder. And we'll talk a little bit about treatment of anxiety and depression because it actually has quite a bit of relevance for the treatment of cognitive difficulties as well. A long time ago, in 1877, there was a man named Dr. Charcot. He was a famous neurologist, one of the first real famous neurologists. And he actually observed cognitive difficulties before a lot of other people. And I quote, this is one of his quotes. He said, "In most of the patients affected by multilocular sclerosis," that's what MS was called at the time, "there is a marked enfeeblement of memory, conceptions are formed slowly, the intellect and emotional faculties are blunted." Now, that's not necessarily a very politically correct way of saying these things these days, but he had the gist right. There is a significant portion of patients with MS who struggle with and suffer from significant problems with their thinking skills. And he noted that in 1877. Despite that, no one really studied this for over 100 years. And it wasn't until the 1980s, and 1990s that researchers and clinicians started to pay attention to the types of problems people with MS have with their thinking. In the intervening period, clinicians and researchers really just focused on whether or not a person with MS could walk, or whether they had physical problems, sensory problems. And so over the last 20 years or so, there's been a real growth in our understanding of the types of thinking problems or cognitive problems patients with MS experience. And we now know that roughly 60% of MS patients experience some cognitive decline, whether that be problems with information processing speed, memory, attention, language, or what have you. We'll talk about each one of those in a little bit. In addition to the more subtle deficits that some people have, between 15 and 20% of MS patients meet criteria for dementia. Now, dementia is a pretty scary word, and if you Google dementia, it'll come up with all these horrible things, but it's reality a medical term, and it's a medical term that has a relatively simple meaning. It just means that there's a change in thinking skills, usually memory and at least one other type of thinking skill, like language or something of that nature, and that change in thinking skills has a negative impact on a person's ability to do the things that they like to be able to do and are able to do. And so for at least 15 to 20% of MS patients, they have a significant change in thinking skills that impacts daily life substantially. Why is this important? Well, there's a lot of research out there that shows problems with cognition have a real negative impact on patients' lives. People who have cognitive problems with MS, people who have memory problems, are less apt to take their medications, for example. So one of the main things people report when you say, "Why didn't you take your disease-modifying therapy?" They say, "Well, I forgot." And the research seems to back that up. Looking at people's memory performance on certain types of tests is associated with whether or not they remember to take their medication, their disease-modifying medications. But really, cognitive problems are associated with even more than that. People with cognitive problems have more difficulty maintaining employment, are more likely to get negative employment evaluations. They report poorer social relationships, difficulties with their family members, maybe family members not understanding the difficulties that they're having because of this invisible nature of cognitive difficulties. Other types of problems people with MS have who have cognitive difficulties, driving is more difficult. Imagine how sometimes people with MS feel slowed down. And now imagine you're driving down the road and a ball bounces in front of you. So we know that people's reaction times are slower when they have cognitive problems in MS, and it can impact things like driving, employment, medication taking, and just managing daily activities. So sometimes paying bills on time, organizing all these different aspects of your life, knowing which appointment to go to, or meeting with a friend, paying all your bills, all of these things are associated with decreased cognitive abilities in MS. So now that we know that people with MS have cognitive problems, maybe 60% or more, and we know that those cognitive problems can have a real negative impact on life, let's talk a little bit more about the types of cognitive problems people with MS have, because MS doesn't impact usually every type of cognitive problem. There are specific types of thinking skills people with MS tend to have more problems with than others. So, for example, attention problems are common in MS. So people with MS might have difficulty tracking what's being said in a conversation or tracking what's being what they're watching on TV or paying attention to what they're reading or listening to a long lecture like this and trying to sustain attention over a long period of time. And so these types of deficits are really common in MS, problems with attention. Similarly, really common in MS are problems with speed of information processing, how quickly you can think, difficulty keeping up with a conversation, maybe someone saying things too fast. They say something to you, and when they move on to the next thing they're saying, you're still thinking about the thing they said before. Or watching a show that's too fast-paced and having difficulty following it because it is too fast-paced on TV. So attention problems, speed of information problems, information processing problems, really common in MS. Other types of problems oftentimes seen in MS are executive deficits. Now, executive deficits is a word that psychologists use, but it really is what it sounds like. So if you think of an executive at a business, what does an executive or CEO of a business do? You might plan things, organize things, juggle multiple tasks at one time. Those are all aspects of executive skills, thinking about more than one thing at a time, coming up with a strategy, planning things, thinking flexibly, problem solving. These are difficulties that people with MS frequently have as well. Now, it's important to note that not everybody has these difficulties. Some people might have speed of information processing problems, but be perfectly fine in terms of their executive functioning. Some people might have executive deficits, but be perfectly fine in their speed of information processing and attention. So everybody's a little bit different with regard to these, but we know that in general, people with MS sometimes have these difficulties. In contrast to these areas, there are some areas that are usually well-preserved in MS. MS doesn't typically cause too many problems with language. Now, it is common for people with MS to have dysarthria, it's called. That can be a slurring of the speech. But that's usually more related to motor problems related to tongue movements and mouth movements, and not language understanding or language production in the purest sense. So this is one cognitive area where most people with MS do pretty well. Language remains largely intact. Although it's sometimes, if rarely seen, that patients have language problems. Visual spatial skills are usually relatively intact in MS as well. Though some people have problems with visual spatial abilities, most do okay. Examples of visual spatial skills, maybe perceiving faces, parking your car between the lines, making sure that you hang a picture up and it's straight. These are all examples of visual spatial skills. And these, although there's sometimes problems with MS, are usually okay. Now, you might have noticed that I haven't said anything about memory yet. And the reason I haven't said anything about memory is that in reality there are lots of different types of memory. And even though we usually think about memory as one thing, psychologists have discovered that there are lots of different types of memory, and that there are some types of memory that patients with MS have difficulty with or sometimes have difficulty with, and there are other aspects of memory that are relatively preserved in MS. People don't have too many problems. So, for example, usually people with MS can remember things from their distant past quite well. They have good remote memory. They'll be able to tell you what their wedding was like. In contrast, sometimes it's difficult for people with MS to learn new information. So they might ask people to repeat themselves multiple times or something of that nature. So learning can be difficult, but memories from the distant past are usually quite good. Another type of memory that people have problems with is working memory. And that used to be called short-term memory. You can think of it as trying to keep multiple things in your head at one time. That's sometimes difficult for people with MS. Prospective memory, or remembering to remember, is another area where people with MS have difficulty. So, for example, remembering to pick up some milk on the way home from work. My wife, I sometimes joke, has problems with prospective memory because she leaves the living room and I say, hey, can you get me a glass of water? And she says, sure, and then she comes back and there's no water to be found. She's forgotten that she was going to get me a glass of water. That's prospective memory. And that is sometimes affected in MS. On the other hand, recognition memory is usually pretty good in MS. An example of recognition memory would be, I don't remember having that conversation, but then someone says, yeah, remember, it was about this, and they kind of give you a little hint or to jog your memory, and you're like, oh, yeah, I do remember now. That's really common in MS. It's in there, but sometimes a little hint is needed to really get it out. So you can see that there are lots of different kinds of memory, and this is actually just naming a few. But types of memory that are oftentimes problematic in MS include things like working memory or thinking about multiple things at one time, learning or needing repetition to learn, and prospective memory or remembering to remember. In contrast, remote memory is usually fine, recognition memory is usually fine, and procedural memory or motor memory, learning motor activities, is usually fine as well. So things like learning to play the piano or ride a bike or something of that nature. If you're thinking that you have some problems with thinking skills in MS, there are a couple of different ways these are evaluated. They could be evaluated by a physician or clinical neuropsychologist who will give objective tests of thinking skills. So, for example, this objective evaluation might include someone saying a list of words to you and having you say the words back and then repeating that list again and having you say them back again and seeing how well you can learn that list of words. And maybe 20 minutes later, they'd say, hey, tell me as many words as you can remember now. Or they might say a story, and how do you try to remember that story? Subjective evaluation is also used. So, for instance, someone just asking, hey, how's your memory? Or are you having any problems with your thinking abilities? Are you having difficulty thinking quickly? Or using questionnaires or something of that nature? And it turns out there's really a big difference between objective evaluation of memory using these types of thinking tests and subjective evaluation of memory, just asking how your memory is. In short, perceived memory problems, or how we judge our own memory to be, is typically not related to objective memory problems. That is, it's very common for people to think that their memory is just fine, but upon objective testing, they can demonstrate significant difficulties, say, with their memory. The reverse is also true. It's not uncommon at all for people to feel like their memory is really quite poor, but then upon objective testing, their memory isn't as bad as they may have thought, and their thinking skills aren't as bad as they may have thought. So this really suggests that you should have your thinking skills tested in two ways, both objectively and subjectively, so you can see the difference between the two, because the treatments might be very different between the two. One of the things the research has shown time and time again is that perceived memory problems are consistently related to anxiety and depression. People with more depression or anxiety are more likely to report problems with their memory. And this suggests the possibility that treatment of anxiety or depression could help people with those perceived memory problems. It's also true that depression and anxiety can cause memory problems, but they're just a different type of memory problem that you have than you have with these objective tests. So, for example, depression can cause a person to be in their head a lot. They can be more apt to dissociate and not pay attention to what's going on around them. And as a result of that, they'll have cognitive lapses, but they're different kinds of cognitive lapses than you'd have, say, as a result of brain lesions due to MS. So this really offers hope for the fact that if people have these perceived memory problems, which can be quite distressing, there's potential treatment for that in the treatment of depression or anxiety. In contrast, when people have problems with objective memory tasks, we know that's highly correlated with disease activity in MS patients' brains. So, for example, the more disease activity in a person's brain on MRI, the more difficulty they frequently have on tests of memory and other types of thinking skills. Both white matter, gray matter, the cells on the surface, and overall size of the brain are associated with cognitive or thinking difficulties in MS. So we think there are two different types of ways of thinking about this, with the objective thinking test being most associated with disease activity and the perceived thinking skill problems being more associated with depression and anxiety. Well, that's not true for everybody, I should say that. If you think you have cognitive problems, you may very well, but it's not consistent. So what can be done about perceived memory problems? Well, like I said, treatment of depression or anxiety is really the place to go. And if you have memory problems, or even if you think you have memory problems, it's important to talk with your physician about this, because then you can have an evaluation to determine whether you indeed have perceived memory problems or whether you also have these objective memory problems. But one way to treat perceived memory problems is with treatment of anxiety or depression. So that might be psychotherapy. It might be medications. Both psychotherapy and medications have been shown to be very effective in the treatment of anxiety and depression in MS. Another thing to do would be to learn about normal memory lapses and normal dissociation. I've had several patients over the years, more than several, I've probably had 50 or so patients over the years who say, "Dr. Bruce, I have problems with my memory when you gave me these tests, and they say that I'm actually doing pretty well." And then I say, "Well, tell me some about the types of memory problems you're having." And they might say, "Well, I forget my keys places. I forget my wallet places. Sometimes I forget the names of people I meet." What I think might be going on here is that these are normal memory problems. I have these memory problems as well. A lot of people have these memory problems. But when you have MS and you forget where your keys are, it's very common to feel like this is because I have MS. So recognize that there are normal memory lapses we all experience as well, and that not every normal memory lapse is related to MS. Sometimes it's just normal. Having said that, like I said, there are a significant portion of people with MS who do have objective memory problems, and there are things we can do to help these people as well. So one way to think about it is in terms of prevention. Now, unfortunately, there is no magic pill. I wish there was a cognitive magic pill. We're working on pills right now, actually, that we hope will improve thinking skills in MS. But as of now, there's nothing that we know you can take that will make your memory and thinking skills better. But what we think you can do, at least to a certain extent, is do things to prevent cognitive problems from creeping up on you. So one of the things to do is take your disease-modifying therapies as prescribed. We know these medications can help slow the disease, and if they can help slow the disease, they can also help slow the onset of cognitive difficulties. it's tough sometimes to take your medications because oftentimes you're taking these medications when you feel good. But recognizing these medications are kind of like a cholesterol medication is important. So you take a cholesterol medication to prevent a stroke, or you take a disease-modifying therapy to prevent a relapse. It's the same kind of thing. So taking these medications regularly may be one way of helping prevent cognitive decline from occurring. Another thing to do is to stay mentally and socially active. People used to think that the brain was an organ that was completely static. If you lost brain cells, you lost them. They're gone. Bye-bye. But we now know that staying mentally active can actually be really good for the brain. It's like exercising a muscle. And so staying involved, staying active may be one way to help prevent cognitive difficulties. Similarly, staying physically active is important. Eating right is important. There are a lot of things that can affect cognition in the brain, not just MS. And if you're not physically active, if you don't eat right, those things can compound the cognitive difficulties associated with MS. So you want to minimize any other things that might cause problems along those lines. And it's the same thing, same lines with drugs, alcohol, and smoking. We know that smoking, drugs, and alcohol can have negative impact on the brain and a negative impact on cognition in some ways. So avoiding drugs, alcohol, and tobacco products is also one way of preventing cognitive problems in MS. Other things that can be done include the treatment of secondary causes of cognitive difficulties in MS. So, for example, it's common for people with MS to have sleep problems. Now, if you're walking through your day all day long, really, really sleep-deprived, that can affect your cognition. So going to a sleep specialist or talking to your doctor about going to a sleep specialist might be something that's good for you. If you can improve your sleep, you might also be able to improve your thinking skills. Similarly, again, treatment of depression and anxiety can be important for treating cognitive problems. People with severe depression and anxiety can have cognitive problems, and the treatment of those severe depression and anxiety problems can improve or lead to an improvement in cognition as well. Another thing you can do is discuss your medications with your physician. So anyone who's taken cold tablets over the counter knows that sometimes medications make you feel a little bit groggy. And people with MS are oftentimes taking 5, maybe 10, and sometimes more medications. And if you're having cognitive problems, having a real frank discussion with your physician about whether or not any of these medications could be contributing to those cognitive problems is a good idea. Are there any other medications that might not have as much an impact on my cognition? And if so, could we give it a try? It's a good thing to think about if you're having those types of difficulties. And then finally, treating sensory disturbances. If you're having visual problems or any other types of sensory disturbances, that just compounds the types of cognitive problems you might be experiencing. So we talked about preventing cognitive problems from occurring, talked about treating secondary causes of cognitive problems. What can you do if you actually have them right now and you don't have any of these secondary causes? Again, I wish I could say there's something that you can just take and you'll feel better and you won't have these memory problems, you won't have these speed of information processing problems. But in reality, the most that we have is finding ways to adapt. And that's really sometimes pretty individual based on what type of cognitive problem you're having. But we can talk about a few of these anyway. So, for instance, doing things like using a checklist, writing things down, being as organized as possible, maybe using electronic aids for prompting you, putting a calendar in a prominent location, writing all your appointments and activities and things in this calendar for both you and your family members. Minimizing distraction. Now, this might seem like an obvious one, but I've had several people who never really thought about it before. So we live in a really complex world. It's not uncommon to be listening to this telephone call and maybe watching TV at the same time and having a conversation at the same time. Now, that's hard for most people to do, but it's even harder for people who are having cognitive difficulties. So trying to do one thing at a time is one way to cope with cognitive problems. Coming up with routines and sticking to routines for important tasks. Getting help from family members or friends. So, for example, if you know you're having problems with your thinking, having a family member come to the doctor's appointment with you. Or go to a doctor's appointment prepared with questions. And bring a pencil and piece of paper to write down things that your physician says. And then just letting people know. Asking people to slow down. Like we talked about before, cognitive difficulties, and this is really an invisible disease, and people don't know that you might be having problems with your thinking and memory skills. And so saying something along the lines of, could you repeat that a little bit slower? I was having difficulty following it. Might be a good thing to do. Making reasonable goals. It's not uncommon for patients to tell me that they had a lot of energy one day. They said all these things they wanted to do, and they get a ton done, but they wore themselves out so much in that day that they were wiped out for 4 days after that. And so setting reasonable goals for a day that won't wipe you out for the next 2, 3, or 4 days is also an important thing to consider. And then finally, along those lines, taking breaks, especially in regards to fatigue, because we know fatigue can impact thinking skills as well. And so allowing yourself to take breaks might improve your ability to focus and stay on task. Just one more slide here about future directions. I think there are a lot of exciting things in MS that are going on in regards to cognition right now. And we know that there are medications that we're trying to improve cognition in MS. There are several clinical trials looking at whether certain types of medications can, say, improve speed of information processing speed in MS. You know, another clinical trial looking at improving memory in MS. There's nothing out there yet. There's nothing that's been shown to absolutely work yet, but we're working very hard at it, and we're trying our best to come up with some medications that can be helpful for people who already have cognitive difficulties. Along those lines, medications that can prevent cognitive difficulties from occurring in the first place are being tested, and we're hoping that these will be helpful and available sometime in the coming years. In addition, research is being done looking at biological and genetic markers for cognitive decline. So, for example, we know some people with MS will go on to have cognitive problems, but other people with MS don't. Why is that? What kinds of things dictate whether or not a person will get cognitive problems in MS versus a person who won't get cognitive problems in MS? If we can identify people early on that we think might get cognitive problems, then we can start a program of prevention early on and hopefully cut those cognitive difficulties off at the pass. And then the final really exciting area of research is actually with cognitive exercises. Like I said before, there's really a use it or lose it mentality. Now, we know that the brain can change as a result of the amount of activity you use. Just like muscles can get bigger if you use them, the brain may be able to get bigger and stronger and have less difficulties if you use it. So there are clinical trials being done now looking at whether or not you can use certain types of exercises. Now, again, there's nothing out there that's definitive at this point. We don't know for certain whether this will work or whether it won't work. And there are a lot of advertisements on TV and those kinds of things that make promises that might not be substantiated at this point. But this is an active area of research, and we hope that it will be fruitful sometime in the near future. So with that said, I want to thank everybody for listening in on this. I'd like to thank people at the University of Missouri Kansas City Neuropsychology Laboratory and at KU Med Center. If you're interested in any of the research that we're doing, please feel free to contact me by my email. It's on the slide if you have it. And I'm open for any questions that anyone might have.
If you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from the line of Journey Slusher.
Okay.
Hi. I have a question. I have the real bad anxiety and depression.
Uh-huh.
And I know when I'm in it. I can't get out of it, if that makes sense. Like, I'm really frustrated and angry, or I can't use the tools that you told us about. Is there something that you would recommend for, like, the instant it's going on? Like, later I can go back and say, oh, I should have done this, but when it's happening right that minute, how do I deal with that?
Yeah, that's a really, really great question. And the best way to deal with extreme depression and anxiety is by striking it with everything you got. And so usually that would involve talking about coping techniques with a psychotherapist. So in doing psychotherapy, we know that can effectively treat anxiety and depression and MS, but also seeing a psychiatrist and having medications for your depression and anxiety as well. And so hopefully with a combination of those two things, both receiving coping skills from your psychotherapy to deal with that, but also having some medication management from a psychiatrist, you'll be receiving the best care that we know about out there for depression and anxiety.
Your next question comes from the line of Barbara Brightman.
I do have a question for cognitive evaluation. Do you see your primary care doctor or your neurologist or a different doctor? We'll get referred to by a different doctor.
Sure. You know, you can usually talk to your neurologist about this. If you talk to your neurologist and said, hey, you know, I think I'm having some problems with my thinking skills.
Okay.
Is there something that I can do about that? They can typically refer you to a clinical neuropsychologist who is a psychologist that's trained to do these types of evaluations of emotional functioning and cognitive functioning. And they can give you a thorough evaluation of all your different types of things. So you could ask for that kind of referral. Some neurologists will do these kinds of tests by themselves as well, though. So it would depend on whether your neurologist felt comfortable doing these kinds of tests to see whether or not you were having problems with your thinking skills, memory, and those kinds of things.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Your next question comes from the line of Dennis McIntyre.
Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I have primary progressive multiple sclerosis. As far as I know, it's primary progressive. They just called it severe when I was diagnosed in January of 1996. And I've done things in the past, like called my sister on the phone, and an hour later, I call her back, and I say, tell her the same thing. I did that for weeks and weeks before she finally told me, don't you remember, you just told me that. And I have no recollection of that.
Yeah.
And but the worst thing, on occasion, I can only sleep about 2 hours at a time because I have aspiration pneumonia ongoing. I have had it for years, and I wake up choking, but there have been times when I've awakened in the morning, and I don't know where I am. I don't know who I am. It takes me sometimes hours to recall who I am, where I am. And then I lie there, and I say, okay, now what do I do? I have no recollection of how to put my legs over the bed and actually stand up. That doesn't happen often, but it's scary as heck. And I don't know that there's any medication or anything I can do for that. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that it sounds like you're really experiencing a whole host of symptoms that are really just very hard to deal with. To have the types of cognitive difficulties you're talking about with your sister and leaving messages and not remembering that, but in addition to have the physical problems you're talking about, which are common to more advanced primary progressive MS, that's a lot to deal with. That's a real lot to deal with. And then in addition, having aspiration pneumonia on top of that, we know that people who have significant physical illness or infection like pneumonia can also have cognitive problems associated with that. It can be related with additional cognitive problems. So, for example, people who have fevers, they might have something called delirium. And so they might not know where they are, who they are, those kinds of things, if their infection is really rampant and really bad. So trying to treat that the best you can and prevent that delirium from occurring is one way to help you so you don't have those types of episodes anymore. But really, I think the important thing here is to talk with your doctor about these difficulties and maybe also talk to a social worker about these problems. Because the thing that I'm most concerned about for you is the fact that you're having to deal with so many things at once. And just trying to juggle all those things and manage all those things, I can imagine it might be helpful to have a second set of ears to listen to what you're going through, but also another person that might be able to help you manage some of those difficulties in your home.
The tip of the iceberg is what I mentioned. I've had pretty much every symptom one can have. I have double vision pretty much all the time. I have optic neuritis, cerebral palsy, intranuclear aplasia.
Yeah.
I'm not ambulatory now, so it just...
Do you have somebody that helps you out?
Yes. I have an aide that stops by a couple times a week, and then people from my church check on me.
Yeah, I think that's the really important thing for you, is to have people in your life that can give you as much assistance as possible. And unfortunately, sometimes the disease gets so bad that it comes down to just needing supports. And unfortunately, in this kind of situation, there's learning to cope with the difficulties, and unfortunately, some of the cards you've been dealt have been really bad, is important, because there's probably really not a lot that can be done to reverse some of the things that you're experiencing with your MS right now. And so learning to cope with those things as best as possible would be really important, whether talking to a psychologist, a social worker, having people come into your house, member of the clergy, and friends and family.
Your next question comes from the line of Barbara Zwett.
Hi, Dr. Bruce.
Hello, how are you?
I'm okay.
Good.
My neurologist has put me on mega doses of vitamin D3,
mm-hmm.
6,000 plus. According to research, from what he knows, that has caused lesions to disappear.
Hmm.
My last MRI was within the last couple months, and interestingly, it was showing after taking this D3 for 31 days, I don't know if it was only the D3, my lesions in my spinal column were disappearing. The
mm-hmm.
brain was stable, or from what it had been when it was done two years ago.
Well, congratulations to you. That's really good news.
Okay. What can you tell me about the research that is being done or has been done relating to vitamin D3 decreasing the lesions?
Yeah. Now, there is no FDA or Food and Drug Administration use of vitamin D for curing MS lesions at this point. There are studies that are being conducted, and this is a new area that people are more and more interested in all the time, looking at, say, for example, blood serum levels of vitamin D and how they can impact disease in MS. But I'm not aware of any research that specifically supports the degree of success that you had, and I would hope that in the future we could continue to look at this doing placebo-controlled trials to really get some scientific evidence to see whether this works for everybody involved.
Well, the neurologist tells me that there has already been research that shows that lesions have disappeared for people taking multi doses or large doses of vitamin D3 or D, same thing. And I'm just wondering where that research is written.
Yeah. I'm not entirely familiar with that body of research that looks at vitamin D specifically. There may very well be some research out there, as your neurologist says, that shows that hasn't met the standard yet that the federal government requires for the treatment of MS and MS lesions. But here's hoping.
Your next question comes from the line of Debbie Thompson.
Yes, sir. My question is about cognition. Uh-huh. If MS takes the myelin off of your nerve fibers, whatever, then no, I already forgot what I was going to say.
That's okay. Take your time.
Well, how can there be a medication to, if there's nothing that restores the myelin, and if the myelin, you losing myelin, which is creating your problem in cognition, how can these new medications on the market help unless, are you saying those will restore myelin?
Well, what we think about in terms of medications for MS, we think about two different types of medications now. One thing is that if you take your disease-modifying medications regularly, and if they develop new or better disease-modifying medications, it might prevent relapses in MS. And in preventing relapses in MS, there might be less myelin loss. And so in that sense, it could prevent cognitive problems from getting worse. There are other types of medications that are being investigated for the treatment of cognitive difficulties in MS. These types of medications can, for instance, increase alertness and things of that nature. They won't repair all the tissue damage done in your brain, and in that sense, you're right. There's no medication that is likely to completely reverse all the cognitive difficulties you have from MS. But there's hope out there. There are clinical trials being done looking at how different types of medications may improve certain aspects of cognitive difficulties, like, say, speed of information processing, say, attention problems and those kinds of things. Although you're absolutely right, it's unlikely at this point anyway to completely reverse any cognitive difficulties a person may have done.
Your next question comes from the line of Deborah Whitmore.
Hi, Deborah.
Hey. Yes, I was wondering about if there's anything you can do for my spelling gets all messed up when I'm writing, and my handwriting is changes all the time.
I'm sorry, your handwriting?
Changes. I mean, it looks different. It's not like it used to be.
Right, right. Well, that's really common in MS for people's handwriting to change, part of that being related to some of the motor problems people with MS have using their hands the way they used to use their hands. There are lots of different assistive devices you can use, though, when you're starting to have problems with, say, writing or spelling or those kinds of things. And really the person to talk to about those kinds of things is an occupational therapist. And so if you're having problems specifically with, say, writing, an occupational therapist might be able to come up with a specified treatment program for you to help you get the things done that you want to get done in relationship to writing. So you might have to compensate by using a different type of writing. There might be a specific kind of pen you could use, or you might use a computer keyboard or something like that. But really, these types of plans are individually tailored based on the type of problem you're having. And occupational therapists are very good at coming up with those kinds of plans for writing difficulties. So you might want to talk with your physician about seeing an occupational therapist and see if they can come up with some assistive devices for you in your writing.
Your next question comes from the line of Dawn DeRohan.
Hi, Dawn.
Hi. I told my doctor about having problems with computing speed, and he lumped it into memory problems. Is there an extra term for the speed of information problem, and why are things lumped into just the general word memory?
And so this is a question about different types of thinking skills people might have difficulties with in MS?
Yeah, specifically with speed of processing.
Yeah, and so speed of information processing is one of the most common problems that people with MS have. And just if you have speed of information processing problems, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have problems in other areas. You might be okay in your memory. You might be okay in your attention. You might be okay in language and other areas as well. Having said that, people frequently use the term memory to refer to all of these types of thinking skills. And so it's not uncommon for people to say, I have problems with my memory. It may really mean they're having problems with their information processing speed or something of that nature. And so how we communicate about these things is sometimes a bit of a challenge because most people don't think about information processing speed as separate from executive skills, as separate from memory problems and all these other different types of cognitive domains. And they just talk about having memory problems. And so if you're having particular problems with information processing speed, you might want to get an evaluation done to see, first of all, whether or not that is isolated just to your information processing speed, and then also to see if there are ways you could compensate for those information processing speed difficulties you might be dealing with.
You have a question from the line of Jane Coates.
Hello.
Hi, and thank you so much for staying MS and helping us out tonight.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Do you see patients directly?
I do see patients. I've seen patients a lot in the past. I've been focusing more on research over the last couple of years. But I would be willing to perhaps see patients, but probably only on a private pay basis.
And I have the most trouble with my memory being retrieval problems. Like, it's there, but it takes me oftentimes longer to access it, and especially in conversation when you need that word, you know, in a millisecond, and don't have it. And then I just stop, you know, and by that time people, you know, start talking and you've lost your conversation space, so to speak, you know.
Yeah.
And then sometimes, you know, like doctor's office, I couldn't remember what my child medicine, what he had had a reaction to, and then it came to me later. And, you know, this was a pediatrician, she said, where'd that come from? It's like, well, you know, I have trouble remembering things.
Yeah.
So it draws attention to itself if you do remember it a couple minutes later.
Right. And that's really what you're describing is a type of memory difficulty that people with MS frequently experience. So that it's in there. They have it in there somewhere, but sometimes it comes out a little bit too late after the moment has passed, or it requires a little bit of a jog to your memory to get it out. And so the good news is that a lot of people with MS do have it in there. It just sometimes, unfortunately, requires a reminder. And then it'll all come back, flooding back like that. So you're describing something that I think a lot of people on the phone probably can relate to.
Your next question comes from the line of Marie Fullerton.
Yes. You mentioned people who had slides have your email, and I was wondering if you could give me your email and then or us, and then I had two comments that might help some other people out who with their problems.
Sure. My email is Bruce, J.M.,
wait a minute, could you go slower?
Sure, yeah, of course I could. See, that's good. That's good. Good skills there. BruceJM at umkc.edu.
umkc.edu.
Yep.
All right. The lady was having trouble with writing. I was helping some a disabled person recently. Her hands are curling up. And we looked at Dragon Speaking Naturally program, and I installed it on her computer, and she's having pretty good success with that because it, you know, you just speak and it writes out, types out all your words and also punctuation and.
So, yeah, I can second that. I've had several patients who have had difficulties along those lines and have used that kind of software and found it to be incredibly helpful.
And also, you talk much about exercise, and you know, there's all these programs on Channel 9. You know, Dr. Emmon, you know, protect your brain, and then, you know, all the benefits of exercising and you know, how that can help.
Sure, absolutely. Now, in MS, there's not a lot of research showing that that's going to lead to improved cognition exercise, in MS specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because there's a lack of research doesn't mean it doesn't work.
With seniors, you know how they're showing that with seniors, how it's helping them.
Absolutely. And like I said, just because there's a lack of research in MS doesn't mean that it won't work.
Right.
And so certainly I would suggest things like staying active mentally and physically.
Right. I go to physics classes at Washington University in the spring and in the fall.
Yeah, that's a great example of staying active.
I never took physics when I was in college, and so it's a challenge.
Yeah. Well, I think it'd be a challenge for anybody. Physics is no easy thing to take. But certainly that kind of thing, taking a college class, doing something new, keeping your mind active as much as possible.
I just feel like it builds a lot of new brain cells.
Yeah, well, what it does is the research suggests that it makes new connections between brain cells. And so making those new connections may very well be one way of preventing cognitive decline from happening. And like I said, there's no actual trial showing this works in MS at this point, but it's not going to hurt you, that's for sure. And there is evidence in other areas, in other types of brain disease, suggesting that this may be of some benefit.
Your next question comes from the line of Robin Holsey.
Hi, Robin.
Hi, how you doing, Dr. Bruce?
Good, how are you?
I was curious when you talked about the medications that are being tested right now for prevention of cognitive. I'm wondering if, because I have had cognitive difficulties before I even knew what was going wrong, you know, before I'd gotten the diagnosis.
Sure.
Example, I had forgotten to pay my rent for 3 months in a row.
Yeah.
And, I knew there was something just seriously wrong at that point, and that was before the diagnosis. So I'm wondering if these medications that are being tested would possibly help my cognition from getting worse.
Well, there's that possibility. There's no research out there yet showing that we have found a medication that will do that, unfortunately. We haven't shown that there's a medication specifically targeted towards preventing your cognitive difficulties from getting worse. There is maybe some evidence to suggest, and at least from a theoretical standpoint it works, that if you have relapsing remitting MS, if you take your disease-modifying medications, that might slow the progression of any cognitive difficulties. Because as we know, cognitive difficulties are related to brain disease as a result of the MS, and these medications can help slow the progression of that brain disease. And so it's a natural leap to say that it would also potentially decrease the likelihood of progressing cognitive problems.
Your next question comes from the line of Curtis Burnett.
Hey, Curtis.
Hi, Dr. Bruce. I'm glad to hear you talk about sleeping problems. I thought maybe I was the only one that maybe had that. I take three different sleeping aids a night and still only sleep about 2 hours a night. I'd wake up about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and just don't go back to sleep. Is there anything, is that a typical of people with MS?
Well, you know, sleeping problems are thought to be really quite common in MS for a lot of different reasons. People with MS can have sleeping problems related to discomfort. Physical discomfort. They could have sleeping problems related to bladder discomfort, having to get up to go to the bathroom all the time during the night. They can also have sleeping problems related to anxiety. One of the most common causes of sleeping problems is sitting in bed, worrying about things, thinking about things in the future that you might have to deal with. And depression is also associated with significant sleeping problems. And so treating anxiety if you have it, treating depression if you have it, can improve sleeping problems. Maximizing your physical functioning and treating bladder problems as much as you can. And then also, there's evidence to suggest that in addition to taking medications, there are behavioral treatments for sleep problems. So talking to a sleep specialist, you might be able to come up with different methods for improving your sleep. And it's called sleep hygiene. And sleep hygiene has been shown to help people sleep as well as medications in many instances. So I might try a lot of those different approaches at once.
We have a question from the line of Todd Croy.
Hello.
Hello, Dr. Bruce. Thanks for being here for us. And I'm more confused than ever.
Oh, okay. Well, let me try to help you as much as I can.
All right. It's a funny disease that affects everyone differently from what I understand, and the myelin doesn't, there's no repairing of it really, but I was diagnosed when I was 39 and a half years old. That was April of 2008. The MRI showed 10 lesions on the brain and 12 on the spinal cord. And my question is twofold to you, and is how often should I have an MRI done, And will an MRI help determine what kind of tests, either objective or subjective, to have for the memory, because that's where I'm experiencing some cognitive issues, I guess.
Okay, sure. So in terms of the number of MRIs you should have, really your neurologist is the best person to answer that question. Your neurologist knows you better than any other physician, hopefully, in terms of your MS. And he or she will be best able to determine how many MRIs you should have and how frequently you should have those MRIs. Now, in terms of your cognition, the best types of tests for your cognition aren't MRIs. The best types of tests for your memory to see how your memory is doing and to think about ways to compensate for your memory are usually paper and pencil tests or tests just talking to somebody. So these are usually done with a clinical neuropsychologist. And there are several clinical neuropsychologists in the area that do these types of evaluations. And you can look them right up in the phone book probably or talk to your neurologist, and they might have someone that they tend to refer to on a general basis. So really, MRIs will give you some idea. We know that lesions as a result of MS and brain disease as a result of MS is associated with thinking problems, but the best way to evaluate thinking problems is by taking different types of thinking tests. And that can be done with a clinical neuropsychologist.
Your next question comes from the line of Teresa Lyons.
Hi, Teresa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wanting to know, I know you talked about depression and anxiety. What about the incidence of bipolar?
That is a really great question, Teresa. And unfortunately, there hasn't been a ton of research out there on bipolar in MS. I think it's an area that needs to be researched, frankly, because at least from my clinical experience, I've seen a lot of patients who have bipolar disorder, who have MS. They've had symptoms of mania and symptoms of depression. And for one reason or another, that hasn't been something that's really been that rightly investigated.
Well, it makes the depression difficult to treat because apparently antidepressants can trigger a manic episode. I'm not so sure that that's the problem. I think that it's probably more the depression and the anxiety, but coming off a really stressful time, there have been an incidence of mania. But, the psychiatrist that I consulted said, you know, if you've had it once, then that's just what you have.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
in terms of the diagnosis of bipolar disorder?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's the way the diagnosis of bipolar disorder works. If you have had one episode of mania, according to the clinical criteria that are set forth, then you, regardless of even whether you've ever had a depressive episode before, then you meet criteria for bipolar disorder, and your psychiatrist is right about that.
Well,
not been
successful in treating, and I didn't know just what the incidence was and if there's any treatment options, because, you know, it's been unsuccessful. Attempted to treat for a year and said, you know, go to your neurologist.
Yeah, I'm really sorry to hear that the treatment has been unsuccessful. You know, a lot of the times treatment of bipolar disorder is a real challenge for psychiatrists and psychologists.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you. I really do think that there should be more research on bipolar disorder in multiple sclerosis. And I hope that more researchers will pick that up as an area of active research. I know that I recently completed a study, and I gave everybody in the study a full psychiatric interview, and I was surprised by the number of people that were in that study who did have a history of manic episodes, and I think that certainly should be investigated more thoroughly. And hopefully we can come up with something.
Your next question comes from the one of Aaron Murphy.
Hi, Aaron. Hello.
Aaron Murphy, your line is open.
Hi.
Hello.
But the memory issues.
Mm-hmm.
on that meal, I was out. Able to grasp different languages.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I'm sorry, Aaron. I had a little bit of difficulty understanding your question. Could you try it again? Hello?
His line disconnected. I'll take the next question.
Okay.
Robin Holsey.
Yes, hi. I wanted just to make another comment that I have been taking Aricept for probably a year and a half, and
mm-hmm.
I feel like it's helped me. Luckily, I can tolerate it. I know that is a problem for some, but I'm curious. I just feel like it makes me sharper, my brain power sharper, and I'm curious, Dr. Bruce, what your opinion is on that.
Sure. That is one of those drugs that is being investigated right now, and hopefully we'll find out what the usefulness of that drug is for cognitive difficulties in MS in the next year or so. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that it does tend to help patients with MS in their cognitive goals, and I hope that your experience is one I'm hoping that your experience is one that the study shows is typical. Now, having said that, having that individual experience doesn't necessarily mean that the drug will work for most people with MS, and so. That's why we have to do these clinical trials, and then hopefully we'll have a more definitive answer on that.
Your next question comes from the line of Julie Pock.
Hi, Julie.
Hi, Doctor. Thank you so much for taking the time for us.
You're
welcome. Easy question. Your email is, I got the Bruce JM at, that's what I meant.
Bruce JM at umkc.edu.
EDU, that's what I meant. Okay. My mm-hmm. other comment and question is, my neurologist referred me to a specialist. I had an 8-hour, testing, written and verbal, and
mm-hmm.
yet she told I am a CPA. She referred me to a clinic, to a, I call her my MS psychologist. I hear
uh-huh.
every week now. She gives me hints on trying to remember things. How long should I see her?
How long should you see who? I'm
my
sure.
Clinical psychologist.
And you're going. You know, how long you should see a clinical psychologist is really something that you should sit down and talk with your clinical psychologist. It's one of those things that that is best discussed with that person. So, coming up with what you feel like the purpose of your treatment is, and talking about what the purpose of your treatment is with your clinical psychologist. Should be a part of your treatment. You should bring it up with that person, with your clinical psychologist, and come up with some goals and talk about, you know, what it would mean to be successful in therapy with your clinical psychologist, and when would success be achieved, so that you would no longer be visiting him or her. So, really, that's a question that's best left discussing in therapy with that person, and coming up with what you think a good ending would be.
Is the fact that I see her mean I did poorly on my written test?
No, not necessarily. There are lots of reasons you can see a clinical psychologist. You know, more than I could.
Referred me to her, though. My neurologist referred me after my neurologist got the results.
Yeah.
And she called me and told me to go to the clinical psychologist now.
Yeah, and what I would suggest is you talk to the clinical psychologist about why they referred you. They'll know.
Okay.
And then should be able to discuss with you the reason for that. It could be any number of different reasons. People go to psychologists, true, for things like treatment of anxiety and depression, but also just coping with MS or coping with cognitive difficulties or coming up with strategies to better deal with cognitive difficulties or a whole host of different reasons that you might have been referred, and I really encourage you to talk with a psychologist about them.
We have a question from the one of Aaron Murphy.
Hi, Aaron. Hello?
Sir, your line is open.
Hello?
Mr. Murphy? Okay,
There's no response from that line, sir.
Okay.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the talk. I appreciate it.
Ladies and gentlemen, please stand by. The polling session is about to begin. Ladies and gentlemen, we have reached the polling session of the conference call. To answer each question, you will need to press the corresponding number on your telephone keypad. Question number one. I learned something that I will use in my day-to-day life. Press 1 for yes, 2 for no. We'll pause for just a moment. Question number two. The content was presented clearly and in an unbiased way. Press 1 for yes, 2 for no. We'll pause for just a moment. And question number three. The speaker was knowledgeable about the topic. Press 1 for yes, 2 for no. We'll pause for just a moment. Thank you. This concludes the Midwest Regional Teleconference Series. You may now disconnect.